Thank you, Paul, and thank you for the invitation to be here. When I heard you say I'd nearly completed my first decade, implication that there could be a second, I felt my shoulders sag. Anyway, thanks for the opportunity to speak today. The previous occasion in which I spoke at this conference, as it turns out, was 6 years ago today, in November of 2009. That conference carried the title The Road to Recovery. And the background to that title was that we'd experienced a downturn in the economy at the end of 2008 as the global economy went into a very serious recession. And so for some months during 2009, there'd been a public discussion about were we in recession or not. Should we use that term to describe conditions in Australia? And I certainly did use that term at the time. But by November of 2009, it was pretty clear that the recession had been short and shallow and that we were in fact already on the road to recovery. And the issue then was managing that next phase, that is, ensuring that the road to recovery met the path to prosperity. At that stage, of course, what has been referred to as mining boom Mark II still was ahead. The terms of trade had in fact fallen by 20% in 2009, but they'd stabilise and they would go on to rise 40% over the next few years. Resource sector capital expenditure had declined in 2009, but it would more than double over the next few years and reach the highest share of GDP for 150 years. Needless to say, they were bigger increases than we expected back in November 2009. An unusually long and strong search for yield in global capital markets, driven by ultra-easy monetary policy in the major jurisdictions, was just beginning 6 years ago. By and large, that continues today, perhaps more so than we might have thought or hoped back then. The European crisis, which would challenge the very foundations of the European project, that was all still ahead 6 years ago, the last time I was here. So there were certainly some surprises in store over that period. But as I think back, many of the features of the next phase in our economic evolution were already, I think, reasonably apparent then, and I think they're still relevant today. It was clear that the remarkable growth of China was a powerful force, and that Australia was increasingly exposed to that growth, which was good, but also contained some elements of risk. It was clear that there would need to be a focus in the years ahead on structural reform. It was clear that improving things like housing supply and infrastructure for a growing economy would be a key theme. It was clear that there would need to be a significant repair of the state of the federal budget so that fiscal expansion would again be possible if needed in the event of a shock as it was in 2008 and 9. All those things were clear then and they were said then. At that time, I said them at this conference 6 years ago. So my theme today is 6 years on from that, where are we? Well, the world economy, despite various threats, has not relapsed into recession. And even with something of a slowing this year, global growth is still proceeding, as we say, at a moderate pace. That said, that growth has required extraordinary policy settings to achieve, and many policymakers and observers find the outcomes disappointing. Most countries around the world would like more growth, but they can't all get it by exporting to others and turning their own demand inward. And for a variety of reasons, policymakers are finding the effectiveness of policies aimed at boosting domestic demand more limited than they might have hoped. In some cases, the efforts to foster growth that way have been not without a degree of risk. For our part, in Australia, I think we can say that we've managed the biggest terms of trade event for more than a century with, so far, some success. Now, history has many examples of such booms which ultimately were not successfully managed and which ended badly. In fact, almost all of them, that's the history. And it's easy to see how that happens. A gift of higher national income comes our way as a result of the discovery of some natural resources or a rise in their price, or both. The higher income permeates through the economy. Before long, even industries not directly exposed to the shock are feeling good. Human nature being what it is, we assume that the good times will last, and we borrow and spend accordingly. Credit growth speeds up, leverage increases, usually inflation goes up, and then the terms of trade turn down, at which point that whole process goes into reverse, usually painfully and usually involving a serious downturn. Well, the current episode isn't over yet, but from what we can observe thus far, I think you can say two things. The first is that we didn't see the same excesses on the upside as we have on previous occasions. I maintain that that has to put us in a better position to manage the down phase. Secondly, in the down phase, which we're clearly now in, we're still managing to grow. We're probably about halfway through now the decline in mining sector capital spending. The headwind from that source is about as intense now as it's likely to get. It's going to continue for a while yet, but probably not at a worse pace than this. And we're still growing. It would be good if the growth were a bit stronger. But nonetheless, over the past year, the non-mining side of the economy has generated respectable growth in employment. The rebalancing is occurring. It isn't as seamless or as quick as you would get in an ideal world, but then we don't live in that world, and we never have. Monetary policy is contributing to that rebalancing, consistent with its mandate, via a very accommodative stance. It seems likely that an accommodative stance will be appropriate for some time yet. I think everyone knows that were a change to monetary policy to be required in the near term, it would almost certainly be an easing, not a tightening. Certainly the rate of CPI inflation wouldn't be an impediment to that if we thought it was useful to do it. The housing market, to the extent that's an issue, may be calming, though by how much and how persistently we can't yet know. Well, since I've mentioned monetary policy, this is probably the opportune moment to offer some observations about the recent change in mortgage interest rates on the part of the major and now a number of smaller banks, and in particular the question of whether the RBA should respond to that with a decline in the cash rate. On some other occasions, certainly, the bank has moved the cash rate more than otherwise to take account of changes in the relationship between the cash rate and the interest rates people actually pay. One such occasion was in May of 2012, when the board wished to ensure that the economy received a worthwhile stimulus from a policy easing that came after a period in which lending rates had been rising even though the cash rate had been steady. The board wanted to make sure on that occasion that financial conditions moved to a clearly easier position than they had been when the cash rate had previously been lowered, which had been 5 months earlier. So on that occasion, we decided on a larger than normal reduction in the cash rate. The question today, of course, is first and foremost, whether the recent changes in mortgage rates result in an effective set of financial conditions that are too tight, quote unquote, for the economy. Well, thinking about that, it's important to recall that over the past couple of years, lending rates have in fact declined more than the cash rate went down. For fixed rate mortgages and many business loans, that fall was actually quite marked. The average rate on outstanding business loans, for example, fell by over 90 basis points, while the cash rate went down 50 over 2014 and 2015. But even for floating rate mortgages, rates had fallen a little more than the cash rate. So that's a piece of backdrop that's important. The actions of those banks that have lifted rates over recent weeks reverse a little under half of this year's decline for floating rate mortgages in the case of owner-occupiers. Of course, they have no effect at this point on the 15% or so of loans that are fixed rate. For investors in housing, these actions and those a month or two earlier reverse pretty much all of the effects of this year's monetary policy easing. But then investor lending was the part of lending that was growing most quickly and the part that we were actually a bit concerned about. And of course, business loan rates haven't risen at all over recent times as a result of these recent actions. So if we take these interest rate changes in the last little while across the total loan book for the system, they're worth about half of 125 basis point monetary policy change. So they take back maybe a quarter of the extent of interest rate easing seen since the start of this year, and a smaller proportion of the total easing in funding costs seen over the past 2 years. For mortgages, it's worth noting, I think, that this increase is from the lowest interest rates that any current borrower will ever have seen in their life. As it is, there are still a number of mortgage products with rates not much above 4%, and there are even a few advertising a 3 before the decimal place. We note also that a significant proportion of owner-occupier households is ahead of schedule on their repayments, in large part because they didn't lower their repayments as interest rates came down. So most of those households are unlikely to need to part with extra cash each month as a result of the recent changes. Equally, of course, most of those households were not raising their spending as interest rates fell, instead allowing their principal to fall faster. It's worth noting as well that in the general environment, according to business surveys, this is not what I say, it's what businesses say in response to surveys, conditions have been improving for about 2 years actually, but certainly over the past year. They've been improving, not deteriorating. So it isn't as though what the banks have done recently in some sense compounds the effects of a deterioration in economic conditions overall. Could the shock value of these recent mortgage changes itself lead to a significant change in that trend of improvement? Well, such an outcome perhaps is conceivable, but given the starting point and all the other considerations I've mentioned, it seems to me a stretch to draw that conclusion. So at this point, my preliminary assessment is that the macroeconomic effects of these recent actions in themselves may not be very large. It's one part of a much bigger and evolving landscape. Nonetheless, the Reserve Bank, as you'd expect, will keep that matter and that broader landscape under careful review. Let me be clear that in making these comments, I am not, repeat, not offering any endorsement of what the banks have done here. Nor should, in my view, an assumption that shareholder returns must never decline as a result of regulatory actions or any other factor be accepted without question. Others have observed that the right, correct, rate of return for bank shareholders is an open question. It's a variable, it's not a constant of the universe. Returning then to the general theme of where are we 6 years on, my next observation is that many of the points that were being made 6 years ago at this conference remain as relevant today as they were then. Yes, Australia's exposure to China has gone up a lot, so China's prospects matter more. The current rate of growth of China's economy is very uncertain, and the future growth rate perhaps even more uncertain. Chinese policymakers are attempting a rather large, in fact unprecedented, transition in their growth model while dealing with some of the legacy issues like a large build-up in debt that are a legacy of the previous growth model. It's likely that the marginal steel intensity of China's growth will be lower in future than in the past. The pessimists would say that the decline in China's consumption of steel we've seen this year may continue. At the same time, the marginal propensity of the Chinese people to consume services is rising noticeably. So the challenge for Australian resource producers of being the most efficient suppliers in a world of slower growth in demand for resources will sit alongside greater opportunities for other firms to offer value-added in services. The challenges of adjusting the responsiveness of our own economy and developing its infrastructure, noted 6 years ago, are still relevant. That's not to say nothing's been done in the interim. Things have been done. But the importance of productivity growth for living standard growth has become surely by now crystal clear as the terms of trade have fallen. The effects of population ageing, moreover, which are slow moving, but they're happening now, they're not just all in the future, add some edge to this. On infrastructure, well, there are some encouraging developments here, and one senses a degree of expectation is building in this space, and that's good. Without wanting in any way to dampen that enthusiasm, I simply repeat things we've said before. The key constraint isn't funding. The key issues are governance, risk sharing, and pricing. The need for medium-term budget repair also remains. Here again, progress has been made, and our budget deficit compares favourably still with what you see in many other parts of the world. But my sense is that a fair bit of the necessary national conversation about how we pay for all the things we voted for is still ahead. That doesn't imply a need for radical immediate action, but I suspect it does mean that an unusually long period of tight budget discipline on recurrent spending is likely to be required. So perhaps the main message that I have is that the nature of the path to prosperity isn't much different to what it looked like 6 years ago. Macroeconomic policies can provide a measure of countercyclical stabilisation, and they've done that, but they can't serve as a magic bullet to achieve sustained growth in living standards. And with the terms of trade-driven improvements in living standards now behind us, and indeed reversing at least in part, productivity is the main game. Gains in productivity will come in part from improvements in the way we do things that we currently do. They'll come in part from stopping some things that we're not very good at and doing more of the things we are good at. Understandably, this is often seen as threatening, and certainly it's disruptive when adjustment has to happen in a short period. It's unrealistic, though, to think that the pressure to adjust is just going to go away. I don't think it will. Equally importantly, and I think this isn't a very important point, gains will come from doing completely new things, the provision of new products to meet people's changing desires and needs. And they will in time be major sources of employment. The answer to the question, which we often hear, where will the jobs come from, is from lots of places that we haven't thought of yet. Many of the jobs in the economy today are in activities that we didn't have or few predicted, certainly 25 years ago. Few would have foreseen the vast growth in employment in a range of industries that provide services to both households and businesses. Employment associated with computer system design, related services has quadrupled as a share of employment over 25 years. Few anticipated, I think, the rapid rise in employment related to social media, cloud computing, the creation of apps, etc., or other services related to environmental sustainability, to think of just a few. So it will surely be the case in future that jobs will come from unexpected places and new occupations will emerge. The questions then are not so much where will the jobs come from. The questions are whether Australian businesses and their workforces have or can acquire the necessary capabilities to offer those services and do those jobs, whether the incentives they face to do so are appropriate, whether the public policy framework appropriately encourages risk-taking and entrepreneurship, and so on. No doubt various aspects of reform are needed to ensure that the answers to those questions are in the affirmative. As on other occasions when reform has been discussed of late, my suggestion is that such reforms are most likely to succeed, that is, they're most likely to be implemented in a durable way, when the conversation is framed within a narrative about growth. Hopefully your deliberations today will contribute to just that narrative. Thank you very much.
David Cox from Challenger. This is, I guess, directed at Peter and Glenn. Before the GFC, there was a fair amount of agitation from the business community about the extent of regulation, and there was a government process, a short government process of a few months run by Peter's predecessor, which produced a bit of a stock and flow of regulatory impediments, and I've got to say not a lot happened as a result of it. And I just want to drag Glenn into it because I have a very clear memory that in either his first or one of his first speeches, he said at that time that regulation was actually becoming a drag on economic growth or on activity. Do you have an idea for a process or a way of moving forward on this, which might be a little bit more successful than the last effort?
No, I'm going to defer to you, he says out loud, to make sure it's really obvious that...
Well, I can only speak, I suppose, about the regulatory dynamics in the financial space, which is the thing that keeps me awake at night on conference calls with Basel and so on. And I think, you know, the fact is that the conclusion that the global community has drawn, rightly or wrongly, is that there needed to be more regulation, a lot more actually, in the financial space. You could argue, I think, and we would have, I think, put this view that maybe what was wrong was not so much that the regulations weren't any good, but they weren't very well enforced, and I think there's a lot to that. But the juggernaut, the tide of international regulation in the financial space, I think is still coming in. We're 7 years after Lehman, and this thing is still building. I think we're probably pretty close to being in sight of where we think the ending point is for things like Basel III, etc. But in other spaces, regulatory initiatives are still unfolding. And that's in... I think the key thing to remember here is what are the incentives that regulators and the political leaders that pass acts of parliaments that give regulators their power, their mandate and their incentives, what are those people responding to? And in the financial space, they're responding to a very deep perception that the system was flawed, that it was in some sense rigged for the large players. Now, I'm not saying they're right, but I think that is the strong perception. And it was inevitable we were going to get a very large tide of regulation coming out of that. There's going to be another point here down the track a bit, where the unregulated parts of the system will grow to be larger, more of the action will be there, and we'll agonise over whether we should regulate them and so on. And I've seen this movie before in our own country. That's coming some years down the track. But right now, the incentives that I think the regulatory community internationally faces in the financial space are those that come from stuff went wrong, people lost money, governments had to put money into banks, there's got to be more regulation, these guys have to be more controlled, and you know, there was no way anybody was going to stand against that tide. So I'm not sure that would generalise to any other regulatory space, but in the part that I'm familiar with, that is a very powerful dynamic, and it's about the lessons that people drew, whether they were correct or not, they drew them from what happened and the incentives that then created to create more regulation. And that's, as I say, I think it's still coming in this tide.
Michael Foley, my question will be directed primarily probably to Glenn Stevens, but also probably to Mr. Harris. The debate we've just been having has been ongoing. It's basically reform atrophy. I'd like to, my question comes back to a talk given by the governor, I think about 18 months ago, where you made your very cautious and considered statement that you felt that probably the long-term capacity growth of the Australian economy, which is normally assumed to be about 3%, is actually possibly lower, maybe something like, I don't know if you ever put a number like 2% because you're so cautious, but would you like to update your thinking on this matter?
It wasn't quite that long ago, it was earlier this year, there was a puzzle that we observed in the data. We observed quite low growth in GDP, 2% or so, but we saw the unemployment rate not rising and employment growth picking up, and there was the puzzle, which is often our business, how do we fit the pieces of the jigsaw together in a way that makes the most sense? And it was possible, a possible reading of the puzzle was that potential growth was lower. As far as what we have done, and we make an assumption about potential growth, and that's been lowered a little bit, basically because the assumed rate of population growth that we get from other places, we get that from population projections and the border protection people that make assumptions about immigration and so on. We take that data to work a population assumption, and that seems to be a bit lower. So we've lowered the potential or trend growth rate just a little bit because of that. We haven't taken a particular view about productivity performance, which is actually the bit we're talking about here. I think the focus needs to be, there's a whole set of issues about how much population we want in the country, separate discussion, but productivity per head of person working is the key thing, given that the world isn't giving us a terms of trade gain now, and given that the proportion of people who are of working age in the total population is going to be going down. So it all comes back to productivity, at which point I throw to the chair of the PC.